Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 64 of the weekly show where we talk about aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me are my two co-hosting pals. First is Rob Mark. Hello, Rob.
Hello there, and welcome, everybody.
Pal number two is Dan Webb. Hello, Dan.
Hello. Greetings from the beautiful, small campus of Bryant University.
There you go, back in school.
Yeah, and Rob, I'd like to point out, I know this is again, but we've gone from co-hosts to friends to co-hosts to co-hosting pals, so I think we're good again.
I think Dan and I are on the same page here, kind of wondering about this huge variance in our relationship.
I have to keep you guessing.
Okay, it's working.
It is working. Well, listen, you know, I might mention also that both you guys, both Dan and Rob, made Shashank Neegum's simplifying list of 11 of the best airline or aviation bloggers / journalists to follow on Twitter. I don't know if you guys saw that.
I actually did. In fact, the way that I did it is I took a pile of that money that the guys from the podcast Down Under sent me.
And paid off.
And I paid off Shashank. So, I mean, it kind of just flows around.
Well, you guys are in some good company. And the list of 11 actually includes quite a few previous Airplane Geeks guests.
Yeah.
Bene Wilson is in that list, Steve Frischling, Addison Schoenland, Mary Kirby, Brett Snyder, and John Ostrower. So,
yeah, actually,
it's a great group to be amongst.
It was pretty nice.
Well, our guest today is Jeffrey Ward. He's the Savvy Navigator. Jeff has been in the travel industry for, I guess, over 20 years, and maybe about half of that with American Airlines. He now provides experiential journeys to South Africa and Argentina and Costa Rica, places like that, for gay travelers. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thanks, guys. I'm so happy to be in this esteemed company.
Well, you might want to reserve judgment till the end, but we'll take that as a good start.
Look, if you guys
and I bet you don't provide travel tips to places you don't personally want to go yourself, do you?
Yeah. Well, I can.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
So first, we're going to talk about the aviation news from the past week. And we've got this week's report from the Airplane Geeks Australia desk. And later, David Vanderhoof will join us for his This Week in Aviation History lesson. And we also have a bunch of listener mail. Hopefully, we'll get a chance to get to that, too. So let's start off with some aviation news. You guys ready?
I'm ready.
Go ahead.
I'm ready.
I am so ready right now.
Our first story comes from Bloomberg.com. This is Airbus loans toward A380 Jumbo faulted in WTO ruling. The Airbus received illegal loans from European governments, the World Trade Organization found in the biggest case yet before the arbiter. The ruling, in a document more than 1,000 pages long, says Airbus got trade-distorting subsidies in the form of development loans from France, Germany, and the UK, and also Spain, at least on the A380 Super Jumbo. This is according to people who declined to be named because the judgment isn't public yet. It's still just a preliminary release of information. Europe has 6 months to respond, and appeals may prolong the final decision to 2012. This is a significant issue in the aviation industry, isn't it?
I'm not sure it is in the light of where the world economies are these days. I mean, Dan, you'd be the better one to tell me the actual numbers, but when we're subsidizing the American automobile industry to the tens of billions of dollars, I mean, doesn't it seem a little silly to be hassling the Europeans over, I don't know, half a billion? I don't know.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting to watch. And, of course, there are other people, myself included, who thinks that Boeing is subsidized in its own way, especially with its military division. So is this going to get prolonged for years? I'm sure the Europeans will appeal. And, of course, the Europeans, the EU, disagrees and thinks that Boeing is getting illegal subsidies. And this has screwed things up with the A350. And, of course, it screws up the tanker even more. So, yay.
The tanker?
Yes. Yes, yes.
Don't tell me it's time for the Air Force to refurbish their tanker fleet again. Didn't they do that just a few years ago?
Well, they try.
Oh, no, no, that's right. That's the one they keep trying to do and can't seem to get very far.
Well, there's a Seattle Times piece, Boeing's tanker bid may gain from WTO ruling on Airbus, that says that the U.S. Air Force must tailor its aerial refueling tanker bid request to consider this this ruling from the WTO that Airbus received some illegal subsidies. But this has been a long standing bone of contention, I guess, between Boeing and Airbus, with each accusing the other of competing unfairly on the basis of subsidies of various kinds from the government. Boeing has for years said that Airbus gets basically free money from the governments that support that company, and that's not fair. Meanwhile, the Europeans or Airbus, you know, counters with a charge that Boeing also gets subsidies. It's just not in the same form as they enjoy over at Airbus. But this thing is likely to drag on for a long time. I mean, there's the appeals process for the ruling that that was just released, but also there's a countersuit by Airbus against Boeing that's due to come up sometime in the future. I think maybe in 6 months. And the whole thing repeats just in reverse direction.
Right. This will happen over and over again, as it has for decades. I seem to recall this actually going on back in the days of the SST.
Yes.
And it was in the 1960s when Boeing was building their SST, and that project was subsequently canceled. But Aerospatiale at the time was completely financed by the Brits and the French. So this is just another chapter in a very, very long, enduring, in my opinion, not very interesting novel.
I think that's true, and it's hard to say what the effect is going to be in the end, whenever the end is, but I find myself wondering if all of the energy expended to get to that conclusion is going to be worthwhile at all.
Well, you know, for Boeing, it almost doesn't make any difference, because as soon as they finish with Airbus, they're going to go after Bombardier and probably Embraer. And so they figure they can keep this going for a long time.
Right, right. I mean, there's also great irony a couple of years ago when Bombardier was going after the Brazilians.
That's right.
And, you know, I thought, okay, this is really ironic. I happened to be living in Canada at the time, and I was just looking at it with the most amused expression on my face, because it's like, hello, Bombardier. Hello, Canadair. I mean, look at your own history.
Did you notice, though, that Jeff mentioned the SST? I mean, he sounds like he's probably almost the same vintage that I am.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
I was a small child.
Wow. a small child. Okay, nice try. Okay.
A four-year-old poring over my Life magazine pictures.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I've got to remember that story. Okay.
Okay, moving on, we have a piece from Network World. Zapping things from the sky, airborne Boeing laser blasts ground target. I thought this was kind of interesting because last week we talked about the problem with folks shining lasers at airliners, and the damage to the night vision and so forth that can cause to a pilot, the dangers of that. So now this is sort of a reverse situation where the plane in the sky has got, you know, one heck of a laser and could shoot back if they wanted. But this story reads, the airborne military laser, which promises to destroy, damage, or disable targets with little to no collateral damage, has for the first time actually blown something up. This came from a C-130H aircraft armed with Boeing's advanced tactical laser, and it blasted a target test vehicle on the ground for the first time. The C-130 fired its 12,000-pound high-power chemical laser through the beam control system while flying over White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. The beam control system acquired the ground target and guided the laser beam to the target. So this is maybe a new era starting in terms of aerial weaponry.
Phasers.
You're just going to move right on to the next step, right?
Yeah, I think a phaser, I mean, I think it's here. I mean, I think Captain Kirk is finally going to see his own here. But I still think these are really, I think this is all nonsense. I think these are really just pilots hanging out the back end of a 130, those little pointer things that you get at Staples. And pointing them at the
shooting
ground.
Back.
Yeah, shooting, getting back, trying to find those people that shot at them last week. Okay, I wasn't really serious about that.
Well, there's a lot, you know, if you're really into the tech part of this stuff, there's some really interesting aspects.
Oh, it is. It's pretty cool.
Some of it I don't even understand. I mean, here's one sentence from the article that kind of struck me, where it says, the extreme scientists at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency said last month they want to develop a laser system that goes way beyond today's optomechanical, acousto-optical, or electro-optical systems to establish, get this, photonic integrated circuit technology that will provide video frame rate beam steering speeds and emit multiple beams, right, with a total output of 10 watts. I have no idea what that means, but it sounds pretty creepy.
I agree.
So my question is, will this be available for home use?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for you to go hang out at the end of the Providence runway there, Dan.
I think Dan could probably operate equipment like this responsibly, but I'm not sure about Rob.
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't trust me with a 19,000 pound
12,000 pound, yeah.
12,000, I wouldn't trust me with it. I mean, think about it. Would you, I mean, let's kind of turn it around. Would you trust me with a 12,000 pound laser in the back of a C-130?
Let me think about that for 3 seconds. No.
Okay.
It didn't take 3 seconds, did it?
So, yeah, Jeff might be different because Jeff also went to Northwestern, so he understands our capabilities, but that's another story.
All right, moving on to the airlines and away from the military, because that went about nowhere.
Okay, so we're not military geeks. We need an airplane geek.
You know,
military.
There is no, in my experience, there was no crossover at all between military aviation geeks and commercial aviation geeks.
I would agree.
It's very rare you find anybody who is completely versatile in, airliner spotting and military aviation plane spotting. It's a different skill set altogether.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think we're a pretty specialized bunch when it comes down to it. All right, from the BBC, we see airline losses hit $1 billion a month.
Yay!
Subtitle, airlines are likely to have lost more than $6 billion U.S. dollars in the first half of 2009, according to the International Air Transport Association. This figure is double the amount IATA said in December that airlines would lose during the whole of 2009.
I hear this data, and it makes me really happy that I'm not working for a legacy carrier right now.
It makes you very happy?
Yeah, I mean, I joined American Airlines in 1989. I left in 2001. I worked there for a lot of the very profitable 90s, and it was a great time to be in the industry. Now, I had colleagues that always looked back and said, oh, the best times were pre-1978, pre-deregulation. But in the past couple of decades, I think the time that I was there was actually really good. So I think it's a really, really tough game to be in these days when you look at these kinds of losses.
So apparently I'm now cool enough to be on the IATA press list. So I got this release. Just saying, I'm almost as cool as Rob now. But it does look like... the way I like to say this is it's getting less crappy rather than improving, but it looks like both freight and passenger traffic it's starting to stabilize a little bit. I'm just reading one data point that said July marked the first month in over a year when the average passenger load factor on international markets did not fall below year earlier levels. So it looks like we're hopefully stabilizing a little bit, and some of the revenue numbers from the airlines that came out this week, it looks like we're moving sideways, but I'd take sideways over down. So,
yeah, maybe we're near the bottom. That would be good news for everybody, I think. All right, speaking of good news and looking at the article from Aviation Week, Lufthansa and JetBlue launch CodeShare. Code sharing arrangement revealed by Lufthansa and JetBlue indicates that 5 city pairs from Boston, as well as 10 round trips from the U.S. carrier's New York Kennedy base. The code share requires U.S. Department of Transportation approval. It's scheduled to start October 8th, and this is something I think Dan's been pretty excited about.
Well, I guess I don't think anyone was surprised about this, because when Lufthansa bought 19% of JetBlue, I think we all thought it was coming at some point. I'm not sure if you would you agree with that one, Jeff?
What's that?
Well, like ever since Lufthansa bought 19% JetBlue, we thought something like this would be coming eventually.
Absolutely. And now, one question I had for you, Dan, was so this is Lufthansa code beyond JFK on JetBlue flights, but there's no intent to put JetBlue code on transatlantic Lufthansa operations, correct?
You know what? I don't know. I'd have to look at the filing for that one, but I believe you if you were in a JetBlue city, you would be able to. JetBlue is saying, well, now you can access over 170 destinations from JetBlue cities. So I have to think there's at least some kind of interline agreement.
Yeah, but if you were the JetBlue people, why would you enter into a code share agreement in which you gave that range of options to Lufthansa, but you didn't enjoy some aspect of that going the other way?
Well, doesn't this mean that doesn't JetBlue actually have to have international route authorities? Oh, those are mostly open skies markets then, so it wouldn't really matter. But your JetBlue doesn't have any operating authorities to Europe, do they? Or does that even matter?
Oh, you know, that's a very interesting question. Hmm. Well, Dan?
I'm on regulations.gov right now, okay?
You got some homework to do, boy. My take on it was an opportunity for JetBlue to have a very nice, very pretty investor back when the deal was done, but it also was an opportunity for some incremental feed through JFK to points beyond. So JetBlue was looking at this as basically a seat filler. And JetBlue was looking at, I mean, Lufthansa was looking at it as a chance, okay, we can now offer, you could fly from Dusseldorf to Buffalo, New York. Aren't using LH code, but they could also do that. If you look at, I mean, the thing that puzzles me also is, you know, where is United here? Where is US Airways here? Where is now Continental here?
Yeah,
it almost
Well, sorry, I think that's huge because Star was so weak in New York internationally, and Continental fixed that. And now you have JetBlue coming in. I think still there's still plenty of room for Continental United, at least in the fact that there are only a few destinations for JetBlue, and then Continental United have these huge regional hubs out of Dulles and Newark. But still, I have to think they're kind of ticked. And then plus, I guess it's interesting considering that United and Continental and Air Canada and Lufthansa all share their transatlantic revenue. So
they do. That was the question I had for you, Dan. Also, was what was the revenue share agreement? Is that the new deal that just got approved?
Well, it's Star Alliance is weird. Well, the other ones are weird too. But like U.S. Airways is in Star Alliance, but they're not in. They do not have antitrust immunity with the other carriers. And so some carriers have that, but then Air Canada, United, Continental, and Lufthansa are now in a separate agreement called Atlantic Plus Plus, which allows them to share revenue and do some other things. And the big issue there is, I think we talked about this a couple weeks ago, something called, with Tom from the airline blog, called metal neutrality. So that way they can all share their revenue and they will still compete with each other. So this is fun.
Is that like the new United Aer Lingus Dulles Madrid route?
I went on the promo page for that and it said like new service to Madrid beginning 2010, asterisk. Some service may be operated by Aer Lingus. Okay.
Yeah. No, I'm sitting here with with no love at all, but rather a complete vantage point of utter judgment on this one. Like, what the hell are we doing here? But anyway, we digress. But yeah, no. So that the fact that there's the A++ revenue share agreement in place makes me think that you won't see JetBlue code on transatlantic operations for Lufthansa.
I'm reading through the filing right now, and it looks like it'll just be Lufthansa codes on JetBlue flights. But I assume that with the way JetBlue is saying this, if you wanted to go through Lufthansa flight, you probably could at least, because I think you could still do an interline agreement, but I'm not sure.
Right. So is this the first time JetBlue will have an interline agreement with an IATA carrier?
I would believe it is, because the only other interline agreement they have is Cape Air right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So this is cool that just an LCC finally has an international partner. So, I think it makes perfect sense because of JetBlue's JFK hub. I'd love to see them expand T5 now to handle international flights.
This brings up an interesting question for me. When Southwest puts this agreement together with, oh my gosh, what's the name of the Mexican carrier?
Polaris.
Polaris. But will Southwest have Southwest flight numbers and codes down through, you know, Monterrey, Mexico on Volaris flights, or because they'll be facing sort of the same thing?
That's right? The way I understand it. Yeah, and the same thing going north on WestJet. That you know that WestJet will start flying Toronto, Baltimore, for example, and that will carry both the Southwest and the WestJet code.
And what about coming back the other way? I mean, Volaris is going to be flying into the States.
Right.
So will they have a Southwest code coming into the States?
I assume that's the way I saw the deal. That's the way I interpreted it.
Yeah, see, those deals are all messy now. I hope that this meal makes Southwest wake up and say, you need an international partner. But they've had IT issues setting up the WestJet and Volaris issue, and also the Southwest pilots really do not like these code share agreements. Because you can do Canada and Mexico with a 737, no problem, obviously.
Sure.
So they're seeing this as essentially outsourcing that's hurting them, especially when Southwest has been flat in terms of growth, in terms of ASMs. You know, they would want the airline to buy more planes, use more planes for this, and then have pilots move up the seniority list. So it'll be interesting.
Well, it's also interesting to note, about a year ago, Southwest had a posting at their corporate headquarters for a job for an international alliance manager.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
And I know some folks from another Dallas-based carrier that have worked in the international alliance environment for a number of years. Where
I wonder who that could be.
I don't know. And we're putting on their nice little outfits and crossing town over to the Love Field headquarters. So I think Southwest has realized, yes, that we need to continue our expansion. We need to continue our organic growth. And I agree, that is going to be a big problem with pilots. And we saw the first round of pilot, I wouldn't say difficulty, but pilots having a voice that killed a deal with the whole Frontier situation that happened last month.
Yeah, what I've heard is hopefully Southwest can get a TA through, because the Southwest pilots were happy that the management said, you know what, we're going to drop this, and that created a lot of goodwill. Hopefully that goodwill is still there. But anyway, just back to this real quick. I think this is cool for Lufthansa passengers, because I think at least compared to United, that JetBlue has a much far superior product, at least in coach.
Oh, well, absolutely. Think about it now. Think about if you're a Lufthansa economy passenger who's going from Frankfurt to Dulles and then flying from Dulles to even Los Angeles. I mean, there's a gross product inconsistencies and that flight may even have the Lufthansa code on it. And, you've gotten your hot meal and your free wine and free good German beer across the pond, and now you're, being forced to pay for your can of Pringles chips on the domestic leg. And I agree, Dan, I think the JetBlue is a much more interesting, innovative product that will appeal to the Lufthansa connecting or transiting passenger.
Our next piece comes from our Don't Play With Matches department. This is Evergreen Aviation.
Rob,
747
listen.
Drops retardant on California wildfires. This is from OregonLive.com. And what this is about is a Boeing 747 that's been modified by Evergreen Aviation to drop fire retardant or water on fires. And they've been using this to help fight the very extensive California fires lately. Apparently this 747 can dump 20,000 gallons of retardant or water. And it can either do that, as the article says, in one giant splash or a series of smaller drops. And this thing is flying for the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. Kind of the most interesting thing I found from this article is the video. It's a Fox News video taken from above the 747 as it flew around and then made two drops of fire retardant. I don't know if you guys got to see the video, but
it was great. It was really, really good.
Yeah, it's really amazing to see something this large flying that low and in that kind of a pattern.
Oh, the question I had was, is Evergreen dedicated a specific aircraft to this mission? that is you know, or is it just go back into the fleet after fire season?
My understanding is it's dedicated, that they invested something like $50 million. And the article says in 20,000 engineering hours to develop and modify this this particular plane. So I've got to believe that that's an investment that they intend to recover over time as they use this in other aerial firefighting applications.
Yeah, because I understand my understanding was that they were going to try and sell this concept to other countries that might have 747s that might be modifiable.
Or let's say that Indonesia starts burning again, and they could, the Indonesian government could hire Evergreen. They chip the plane over, and the plane could fly missions over there on behalf of the Indonesian government.
One advantage, I think, of the 747 application is that, unlike most other aircraft used for this kind of service, besides carrying a lot more fire retardant or water, this thing is significantly faster, so it can get to the scene of the fire much more quickly than sort of the conventional aircraft that are often used.
Yeah, but I still can't imagine. It's got to be really interesting flying an airplane that big, that close to the ground. And I know the guys in the B-52s do it all the time for the Air Force, but of course they're also used to doing it. And they have terrain following radar, so I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, the most interesting angle to the story might be who's the pilot and where did he come from and what's the experience base of him is.
Yeah, it's not me.
Well, is he just one of the regular Evergreen pilots, I wonder, or is it some guy with some kind of special military mission?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Rob, maybe if they equip an A380 with this, maybe then you can do it.
Well, that would be true, yes, because I don't see myself just flying an average airplane like a 7-4 or something. That would be, it would be somewhat beneath me.
Okay, we have one general aviation story.
Oh, gee, how'd that happen?
Well, because it's
Dan,
so juicy.
Obviously, you didn't get to edit anything this week, did you?
I sent this one in.
Did you really?
Though granted, it was found via, I'm not sure if you guys read this, but every week, Benay Wilson, who's been on the show a couple times, she has a weekly strange but true aviation news, and it's just hilarious.
And this is a good one.
You made the strange but true this week?
No, but nice try.
Sorry.
This is titled, Drunk Pilot, Where Have You Hidden the Runway? This comes from The Telegraph. Apparently, this 65-year-old, they call him amateur pilot, allegedly tanked up on beer and wine before taking to the skies in his Cessna. And then once airborne, he served himself some more cocktails while at the controls. So apparently, several hours later, he was so drunk that he couldn't read the instruments and had no idea where he was. So there was an interesting conversation that ensued with air traffic control, and where he radioed, "Come on, I know you're down there. Where the bloody hell have you hidden yourself?" So apparently he's also singing a few songs. He told a mother-in-law joke, doesn't say whether it's about his mother-in-law or just mothers-in-law in general. So in response, a rescue helicopter was scrambled, went up, and gave him instructions to follow the helicopter back to the airport, which apparently he did without further incident.
Oh, no, there's a job I'd want. Being in the helicopter in front of an idiot that's drunk,
yeah.
Hopefully he doesn't run into me.
Yeah, that should get hazardous duty pay, I think.
Good Lord.
Today's guest again is Jeff Ward, the Savvy Navigator. Jeff, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'll start with kind of a multi-part question.
Oh, you're going to steal a few more of mine? Great, thanks.
Well, you know, I had that exact thought. This way I could, you know, triple my... It's three parts, and this way I can triple my chances of coming up with a question that Dan was going to ask. So, Jeff, when you talk about experiential journeys, can you tell us, you know, what does that mean? What are the important elements from the customer standpoint? And now this is my real question. What role does the airline play in providing that overall experience?
Yeah, the journey, in my opinion, begins the minute the traveler leaves his or her front door. So it's everything that happens along the way. So it could be the transportation to the airport. It could be the in-flight experience. For me, the experience actually begins when I'm actually doing the planning and doing the whole travel planning process.
Right.
But the experiential journey, as I define it as a savvy navigator, is really about having an immersive, authentic experience. What I'm offering is group tours. And group tours have been around for a really, really long time. And people ask me, well, why and how is a savvy navigator tour different? You know, what is, it's your question, what is the experiential journey? What it is, it's the chance to experience a new destination, kind of peek beneath the covers, so to speak, or get beneath the skin of the destination, and then experience it in a way that the typical tourist doesn't usually experience that destination. So if I look at the offerings to South Africa, for example, that my competitors, for what they are, I don't really consider that I have any competitors, but what is it that they offer? They offer the same tours to the gay clientele that the straight tours offer to their clientele. But just so it's the same tourist restaurant, it's the same tourist hotels, it's the same experience you're going to get on any other package. What I offer is I have a partnership with South African Airways, for example. So I've got a great relationship with my local salesperson in Washington, D.C., who will bend over backwards to make sure that the Savvy Navigator guests going to South Africa fly on South African, either out of the JFK or the Washington Dulles Gateway, and have a great experience there. But what we do is we bring to our groups the kind of travel that my partner Michael and I enjoy. So that's spending two or three nights, spending a bit longer in the destination, dining in restaurants that are off the beaten path, that are known and loved by locals, staying in guest houses or boutique hotels that are either gay-owned or very gay-friendly. Going on safari in a really luxurious way where you have the most amazing safari experience, but it's done in such a way that it's really, really fun, and it's actually life-changing. So, you know, my career that I had between the airline industry and being a tour operator was that of executive coach. So I helped folks find passion in their work and really change their lives in the direction that they desire to go. And I'm doing the same thing with Savvy Navigator. I'm enriching lives, and I know that sounds like a cliche also, but I'm really offering something that will change your life. And when you get home, you'll have newfound knowledge and wisdom that you wouldn't have had before.
Jeff, does your airline experience, did that tell you what to do, or did that teach you what not to do?
Actually, that's a great question. A little bit of both. You know, I spent most of my adult life at American Airlines, and American Airlines is a very, very well-run company. It is a well-oiled machine. And it taught me a way to think. It taught me a way to approach problems. It taught me about customer service product design. I spent my early day food and beverage group developing products like the domestic snack service, back when there was one, or the international flagship service, or redesigning Caribbean menus. So it was really about listening to what your clients and your customers want and then developing products that meet their needs. And I think American Airlines has always been a leader in that. They haven't always been the most innovative as far as product development. I think a lot of the foreign carriers are better at developing lie-flat seats or other products. But American does a very, very good job of identifying products that it's what its core business travelers want. So learning that there has helped me approach building the Savvy Navigator business with the same kind of discipline and focus. Before I launched, I did lots and lots of market research about what my clients wanted.
Oh, that must have been real hard, going to all these amazing places.
Well, what I found was is that Michael, my partner, turned 40 back in 2007, and I put together a really, really terrific trip for 25 friends and family, notwithstanding burning off a bunch of United Airlines Mileage Plus miles for a really, really kick-ass itinerary for us in business class, going through Germany, down to Cape Town, Joburg, and then back on the South African Airways, direct flight over Dakar back to Dulles. And I realized I loved putting that trip together. And not long thereafter, the company in Cape Town that had done all of my ground handling and logistics and destination management in country approached me about jointly developing product to sell to the gay and lesbian market segment back here in the U.S. And that's why South Africa was the first market for us, and that's how Savvy Navigator was born.
Which, you know, Jeff, I wonder when, at least to me, I think of South Africa as being one of the areas that would probably be least friendly to people of different kinds of lifestyles, especially based on their own history. Did you run into any difficulties, you know, trying to put this together for gay individuals, or did it just come all come together real easily?
It came together really easily. I started.
So this was a
South
really
Africa.
Stupid question, then, right?
No, it's a great question. No, okay. I started going to South Africa in 1999. I was my final gig at American Airlines. I was posted over at British Airways Waterside World Headquarters to be part of a One World team. And there was one of us from each One World partner carrier based at the London headquarters. And we were developing country-specific sales and marketing programs. And South Africa was one of our launch markets. So I spent a bit of time in South Africa, and I really got to know it and loved it. And it struck me as a really, really open and accommodating place. Now, one of the interesting little factoids about the new government that was created in 1994 was South Africa was one of the very first countries, if not the first country, to actually write into its new constitution no discrimination based on sexual orientation. So the gay and lesbian traveler actually has more rights in South Africa than in many other countries they travel to around the world.
Hmm.
Codified in the constitution.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's very interesting.
Wow.
And South Africa, and Cape Town, I mean, in your big urban centers, in Cape Town, for instance, Cape Town is very similar to San Francisco or Vancouver. That's the real feel and the vibe of the city. And you guys may or may not know that both of those cities are very friendly towards gay and lesbian residents and travelers who are visiting those cities. So Cape Town is very, very, very open and accommodating. And actually, one of the interesting places that we go on our tours to South Africa is there's actually a farm about 2 hours north of Cape Town, up the Western Cape, and it's owned by a farmer who's gay. And he's the eighth-generation farmer. His ancestors settled this 2,000-hectare farm, over 200 years ago. And he runs it, and it's a working farm. He really cringes when I call him a gentleman farmer, because he says, I'm a real farmer. But he has eight of his old stables converted into very, very comfortable guest rooms. And so that's one of these kind of authentic, immersive, experiential, or one of these experiences that really makes our tours very different. And it's because we're being hosted out on this farm by this gay farmer on his amazingly beautiful farm in his amazingly beautiful kind of colonial Cape Dutch house, in the manor house. So it's an interesting place. I mean, the same reason, that's why we're going to Argentina in 2010 and also going to Costa Rica. Those are both destinations where, number one, my travelers want to go, but number two, they both have very, very good track records for lack of discrimination.
Is your company like a club, Jeff? I mean, that people are essentially members, and because they're members, they find out about your service, or is this just anyone that calls up can take advantage of? Or
I'm a tour operator. Okay, so I offer tours, and I offer tours to. In this year, I offered tours to South Africa. Next year, I'm offering South Africa, Argentina, and Costa Rica. Like I said. My groups have between 6 and 12 travelers in the groups, but what we also do is we can let's say, you know, two couples want to go, and I can put together a similar tour for them as well. So it's not a club per se, but what I found is that once people travel with us once, they like the way that we do things, and they want to travel again and again. So one of the reasons why we decided to go to Costa Rica next year is that one of our guests who went with us to South Africa back in May said, you know, I've been wanting to go to Costa Rica, and I'd love to travel with a group of guys like this. So that's why I ended up developing product in Costa Rica.
Wow, that's pretty wild. I'm sorry, one more question, then I'm going to let Dan talk because I know he's going to get really upset if I don't let him get it. But I'm just curious, what is the one thing, if there's one element of your tours that people say, oh my gosh, this is why we find Jeff, because what would that be, do you think?
I would say it's the authenticity of the experience. Basically, it's the savvy navigator knows his stuff, whether it's from how to get a business class seat on airline X using airline miles, to best time of year to travel, to best Indian restaurant to dine at in Cape Town, which I can tell you, down to the best guest house or the best place to see wild dogs while on safari in the Sabisan Reserve down by Kruger National Park. It's because I've spent my entire life literally globetrotting, I now bring that wisdom and expertise to you to help you have the most amazing trip, the most amazing journey.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right, I just have one question because these two whatevers, I'll be nice, stole all of mine.
We'll let you go first next time, Dan. We promise.
Jeff, I know you just went to Costa Rica a little while ago. So when you've landed a destination, like how much do you plan out before, like, or you just like, I'm gonna explore this city for a day and find all these like what's your plan when you scope out a destination?
When I open a new market, I always seek out a local partner that knows the country and that can help me plan my tours, who has experience in this area, but who also gets me and gets what I'm about. So let's use Costa Rica as an example. I asked around, ended up talking to three different tour operators in Costa Rica, ended up partnering with the guys from Nature Air. They have a fleet of, I think, five or six twatters, and they provide a lot of the domestic lift within Costa Rica these days. And most tour groups and many travelers use Nature Air. So they also have a subsidiary called Nature Vacations, which can basically design trips with me that they then sell to me, which then I can then resell to my guests. So in this case, I was looking for a completely vertically integrated supplier. They have the ground handling. They have relationships with all the lodges. They know the best place to go zip lining through the canopy of the rainforest. But they also have a fleet of well-maintained carbon-neutral twin otters to fly us between Fortuna up in the north and San Jose or Cape Coast down in the south. So I have the same kind of relationship in Argentina. And the original partners, Southern Destinations over in South Africa, are the ones that I pretty much developed this model with. So what I do is I rely on local expertise along with my own experiences in country to put together the absolute perfect itinerary.
Great. Okay, Jeff, we have a little game we subject our guests to. It's called Word Association, which is just what it sounds like. So we'll say a word or a phrase, and you can just start talking about whatever comes into your mind.
Perfect. Love this.
And so to avoid more flack for Dan, we're going to let Dan go first.
You're so nice, Max. All right. So Jeff, since you worked for American, my word is United.
Good one.
Big and boring and inconsistent. It's funny. Even though I worked for American Airlines for 12 years, there's a reason why I was recruited by them. I was a really, really good cultural fit for American Airlines as an employee, and I'm still a good cultural fit for American Airlines as an Advantage Platinum flyer. I have never felt that kind of rapport with United Airlines. And when I was being recruited by United Airlines, I never felt like it was a good fit when I was going through the halls of Elk Grove Village. And I've never felt the same level of comfort with them as a passenger. Now, they're a totally fine airline. They have a great network. They go to a lot of places that I go to. Actually, I was supposed to be on them this past week, flying from Dulles to Beijing. But I just... They're a different family from the family that I'm used to.
Hmm.
How's that?
Interesting.
I like it.
Rob, have you got one?
Well, it's a phrase, I think.
Not allowed.
Well, I know. But
I'm joking.
Okay. Our next destination will be...
...
Most likely something in the South Pacific. I'm thinking New Zealand.
Oh, yes.
And the reason why is this. My beloved husband, Michael, is going to a conference in New Zealand in Wellington in November, and I'm tagging along. And I, this trip has multiple different reasons for existing. Number one, I get to fly on the A380 for the first time. LAX, burning off some of my Advantage miles. But what I plan on doing is meeting with some folks in Sydney that might be possible partners for me. And then Michael and I are going to go to the South Island of New Zealand and have a look around ourselves for a few days after his conference is over. And I also want to meet some folks there who might be possible partners for us. Again, for some reason, with the exception of Costa Rica, I seem to keep being drawn to the Southern Hemisphere. But I will say the price-value ratio for the dollar, the PVR, as I call it, is pretty darn good the further south you go.
So, Rob, now Jeff can go down and collect your money from those guys.
From the guys down under. Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Good answer. Thank you.
Yeah. All right, Jeff.
Jeff, are you doing business class in Qantas? Because I sat in that seat a couple weeks ago and I liked it a lot.
You know... I actually am, right now I am booked in economy, but it's only costing me 70,000 miles.
Oh, nice.
Dulles, LAX, Sydney, and then Christchurch, Auckland, LA, Dulles on the exact travel dates that they want. So it's 75,000 miles. And the other interesting thing is that let's just say that I have a, from my old One World days, I've still got some friends at Skippy HQ that I hope to suck up to.
Skippy HQ. Well, you know, if you can't get business, their premium economy seat, I was actually very impressed with it.
You know, I've flown their, I'm assuming the A380 business class seat is the same seat on the 744, is it ER or LR? Which I've flown on, so I think it's the same seat. So it was, that was a pretty darn good seat. I also had friends that did fly the premium economy cabin on the A380, that little gentle cabin in the rear upper deck, and they said it was really good as well. So I'm looking at this as just a big adventure, and it's so darn cheap mileage-wise, I figure I can endure anything. And I think Dan knows well enough at this point, I'm not usually a happy person in the main cabin. I like to have space and comfort.
Yeah. At least,
you know what?
Well, at least you're on Qantas, unlike United, because at least Qantas has personal video screens.
Exactly. And the other thing I'm curious about, on the Auckland LAX trip, it's the Qantas high-density configuration. I think it's 34 business seats. There's no first class. It's like 34 business class and, you know, 712 economy or something ridiculous. But
oh, God.
I exaggerate. But anyway, but you know, it's that configuration. So, you know what? I got a great deal. Hard dollars out of my pocket was, you know, $66. I can fly from Sydney over to Wellington on either Jetstar or Pacific Blue. So, you know what? Either way is fine. I'm excited about it.
Great. Jeff, to finish up, if I mention the people we call airplane geeks, what does that bring to your mind?
My life story. okay, so here's this is our true story. My first year at Kellogg, which is the School of Management at Northwestern University, my first week at Kellogg, the Transportation Center offered a career day for people interested in transportation and to help them with their resumes. And I went over to the Transportation Center, and I met a second-year MBA candidate named Steve Orr. And Steve and I started talking, and I felt like I met my soulmate on the kind of airline geek level for the first time. He and I both had flight databases tracking our tail numbers of all the flights we've ever been on. And it was like, you know, going into an AA meeting or something, you know, not American Airlines. It was like going into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I met my people. And since then, I've met, and then another airline geek, my friend John Henry Pollock, who is also a general aviation pilot, kind of entered my life. And so I have this amazing circle of airline geeks that I have an insatiable appetite to just talk with. And that's one of the things about the whole world of social media with Twitter and Facebook is that I've met this whole new generation of airline geeks. So I met Dan this way, and then there's, you know, young Ian, the Clipper kid, who is about Pan Am. And one of my favorite bloggers is Ben Saudoui, a young Emirates flight attendant based in Dubai. So there's this whole new generation out there that I enjoy being in dialogue with, and I never thought I would be kind of one of the elders in the airline geek universe, but I have gracefully entered into that role.
Geekdom, we call it geekdom.
At the ripe old age of 48. But anyway, you know.
Jeff is as old as Rob. I call him my aviation grandpa now.
Yeah. Well. So I'll just tell your aviation uncle.
Absolutely.
Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Hey, you guys, thanks for being here. I mean, and thanks for letting me like mouth off, because, again, I love getting on my soapbox about stuff. And thanks for letting me showcase my business. I really, really appreciate that.
Well, tell our listeners where they can find you online.
www.savvynavigator.com. SavvyNavigator. And look for us, and I've got a blog on there, and on my blog I've recently posted some videos of my past.
Yeah, those are pretty interesting.
Back in the 90s, I was the seat cushion guy as flotation device demonstrator in the American Airlines safety videos. So if you go to thesavvynavigator.com/blog, you'll see my youthful face and body demonstrating all kinds of cool things on the Airbus A300, the MD-11, and the 767. So I put those on there, and so I think airline geeks will find those of interest.
Terrific. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, okay, Jeff.
Thanks, thank you, Jeff.
And now here's David Vanderhoof, the official Airplane Geeks historian with This Week in Aviation.
Thanks, Max. Before I begin, I'd like to send my thoughts and prayers to anyone who was affected by the events of September 11th, 2001, and we'll just move on from there.
Yeah, echo that.
Agreed.
Yes.
Okay, well, welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 1, Episode 14, September 6th through September 12th. Class is now in session. Robert? Robert, please stop picking on Dan. Max, thank you for the reliable AV Geek Squad. As for our Australian exchange students, Stephen Grant, please do keep your translation dictionaries handy. We do understand you have problems with language. And Dan, it's okay. There will not be any pronunciation exams tonight.
Well, that's good, because I moved in today, but I don't have classes until Tuesday. So,
right. Let's begin. Last week, we learned about Adolphe Pigou. Class, does anybody remember what Adolphe did last week? Anyone? Anyone?
Something German.
Is there anyone besides Mr. Webb who can answer?
He flew inverted.
Very good. Yes, Adolphe was the first person to fly an aircraft inverted. Well, on September 6, 1913, he became the first person to loop the loop in an aircraft.
Boy, this guy just couldn't keep from doing crazy things, could he?
Absolutely not. September 6, 1948, a de Havilland DH-108 Swallow breaks the sound barrier for the first Commonwealth aircraft to do so. It was also the first jet-powered aircraft to break the sound barrier officially. The actual first jet to do so was the P-86 Sabre, which did it in April 1948, but was kept classified for U.S. security reasons. The Sabre did it in a dive. The Swallow did it in level flight. And Mr. Mark, before you ask, the X-1 was a rocket-powered, thus the difference.
Okay, you know, I liked this guy David when we first brought him on. I'm not sure here anymore.
Oh, I like him more now.
No one said anything about having to remember the bits that he did from last week. No one told me about that. So
you got to pay attention.
I'm keeping my eye on you, David.
Except we can't see him through Skype.
That's right. Can't see him through Skype.
On September 8th, 1927, Clyde Cessna begins Cessna Aircraft Corporation by going out on his own. He had been part of a triumvirate of aircraft designers who had formed Travel Air Corp. The other two were Lloyd Stearman and Walter Beach, whose collaboration does explain why Travel Airs, in this teacher's opinion, are really beautiful. But I digress. On September 9th, 1911, the first Royal Post is delivered by air from Hendon outside of London to Windsor. Gustav Hamel flew the 10-minute flight over the 21 miles in a Berlioz monoplane. For Grant and Steve, that would be a 10-minute flight over 16.09 kilometers. On September 12, 1970, the Concorde made its first landing at Heathrow Airport. This was a test, not a scheduled flight. So no, Mr. Webb, the flight did not generate any revenue.
You know me too well.
On September 12, 1961, the Hawker Siddeley P-1127 Kestrel makes the first transition from vertical flight to horizontal flight on jet thrust and back to vertical flight. The Kestrel was the predecessor of the Harrier jump jet. And then, okay, class, this week's in computers, and this is important, so pay attention. Mark, there will be a test later. On September 9th, 1914...
This teacher is really boring.
Oh.
Don't interrupt.
On September 9th, 1945, the first bug in a computer program was discovered by U.S. Navy officer Grace Hopper. The Mark II computer was not working properly. A moth had flown into the computer relays. The moth was removed with tweezers from the relay and taped into the logbook. It was also that day the term debugged was coined. The logbook and the critter taped to it is now on display at the Smithsonian Institute for U.S. History.
I'd like to point out, I did a project on her in eighth grade, and it was awesome. Sorry.
And of course, you got an A, right, Dan?
I did. It was for this Natural History Day thing, and dude, it went places, okay? I'm sorry. Still happy about that.
And last but not least, the first flights that occurred the week of September 6th through September 12th. The Bell AH-1 Cobra flew on September 7th, 1965. The Avro BAE 146 airliner flew on September 9th, 1981. And that's the way it was, September 6th through September 12th, class dismissed.
Thank you, Professor Vanderhoof.
Outstanding. So, David, you think you might have some theme music coming, I understand, right?
I have a very, very good friend who's a professional composer and has offered me to write a piece. So maybe I'll get my bumper music and we won't have to pay royalties on it, which is a good thing.
And I'll be doing the vocals.
Oh, my gosh. Uh-oh.
This week in aviation history. Yeah. Please put that in the bloopers.
Okay.
All right. Thanks. Thanks, David.
All right, guys. Don't you have some homework to do or something?
Like I said, classes start on Tuesday.
Oh, okay. I'm just checking.
So, as I mentioned last week, I was at the National Business Travel Association conference in San Diego. I'm promising a couple weeks I'll shut up about that. But like I said last week, one of the big events is the airline CEO panel this year was Larry Kellner of Continental, Gary Kelly of Southwest. And after that, I was able to sit down with Gary Kelly with a couple other bloggers. And I was able to get a couple questions with him for a few minutes. So enjoy.
I think this could be one of the questions that you can't answer. We'll see. I have a few of those.
Good. It'll make it easy on you.
Okay. So I was listening to both Frontier conference calls. And during the first one, when Lynx was brought up, it seemed the answer was, well, we'll look at Lynx, but we're not sure about it. Mm-hmm. A week later, it seemed, we like Lynx, we'll keep operating it for more than 2 years, and we think the Q400 is a cool little aircraft. So what's your future potential for any regional operations?
I think that was just live analysis that was taking place. You might remember, Dan, that if you go back to probably our earnings call in late July, I think I actually got that question. I think it was a media call. And I told folks that, I told listeners at the time that we don't have a vision for a regional jet or similar operation. That's just not where we want to take Southwest Airlines. In the Frontier case, it's there. And it was a matter of us trying to figure out, while it doesn't necessarily fit with our vision, to win the bid, we were going to have to deal with Lynx one way or the other. And we had, I really think, three choices. Ultimately, we could buy it and operate it ourselves. We could buy it and sell it and co-share with somebody. Or we could sell it to someone else to feed into Denver. But it was very important in terms of the community. The communities that are served by Lynx, that service be continued, and we understood that. So we were willing to honor that. We just didn't know how we would do that. But now that we are not requiring Frontier, it's a pretty easy answer, which is no. That's not a vision that we have, unless there's some set of circumstances that would cause us to do this.
Boeing and Airbus, their date for a potential narrowbody replacement has been 2020 at the earliest. How does that fit into your fleet plan? And I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on the Bombardier C series.
Well, we'll need to. We have objectives, of course, financially to boost our revenue production and keep our costs under control. In an environment like this, that's so difficult economically, we desire to reduce our costs. So. New fleet technology becomes a very significant component of trying to achieve that objective. I think that means simply that we'll need to continue to keep our options open in the future about fleet types. While we have a wonderful partnership with the Boeing company, and would love to continue to fly Boeing exclusively, I don't think we can simply say that is a law that can't be violated. It's just one of those paradigms that we may have to continue to challenge. And at the same time, we don't have any plans to buy anything other than Boeing 737s at this point. We're anxious for the next generation technology to get the increased fuel efficiency, better maintenance efficiency, and would welcome that solution as soon as we can get it from the Boeing company.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, September 5th, 2009.
Oh, gee, that sounds so much better than the intro last week we had. How are you, folks? It's Steve Vischer here, sitting here on a lovely Sunday morning here, and it's actually Father's Day, and I'm here with Grant. Happy Father's Day to you, mate.
Yeah, and happy Father's Day to you too, mate. I sort of did my Father's Day celebration yesterday when I went and hung out at the air show and got to interview some people and play around with some really cool, sexy planes.
You're only just saying that to rub that in because, as you well know, I was at work.
Oh, were you? Oh, I'm sorry.
Ouch, I'm mortally wounded.
Ta-da.
This is the Australia Desk, folks, for episode 64 of the Airplane Geeks podcast, and we've got three quick stories this week. And Grant, let's just throw to our first one here. We're talking about our friends at Qantas, the flag carrier of the nation.
Oh, yes, our favourite flying rat, the one that we love to look at and salute when it flies wonderfully over us.
Yes, except for this particular 747-400, perhaps.
Yeah, this particular 747-400 is getting a similar reputation to the one known as the Golf Buggy. That was the one that went off the end of the runway at Bangkok and to a golf course and is now known as a Golf Buggy.
So this happened earlier during the week, a Qantas flight coming from Singapore and on its way to Sydney, actually, was forced to make an emergency landing at Perth over in Western Australia after fuel started leaking from an engine. Qantas Flight 32, it's a 747-400, was carrying 290 passengers and landed at 3:20 p.m. local time. The leak was found in the number 4 engine and was shut down by the captain as a precaution. Now, Grant, as you were just saying, this plane's got a bit of an interesting history. Maybe you can elaborate on that.
Yeah, mate, the first aircraft I was talking about, known as the Golf Buggy, is, of course, Victor Hotel Oscar Juliet Hotel. That was the one that overran the runway at Bangkok and wound up on the Thai Air Force golf course that's between the runways at Don Muang in Bangkok. Wonderful golf course. I've played that one a couple of times, and I tell you what, I have the worst game of golf ever there because I'm so busy looking at planes. But no, this aircraft was Oscar Juliet Kilo, and Oscar Juliet Kilo was the famous QF-30 flight that was flying from London Heathrow to Melbourne via Hong Kong, and on the way out of Hong Kong towards Melbourne, it had an oxygen cylinder rupture and blow out a big chunk of the fuselage just in front of the leading edge of the wing. They made an emergency descent and then went and landed in the Philippines. It caused quite a stir. So this particular aircraft, Oscar Juliet Kilo, has now been involved in the fuel leak in the number 4 engine.
It says here in this article we're reading, Grant, which is in the Australian, and actually just for a change, not by Steve Crady, that the aircraft is 18 years old and is actually due for retirement this coming November. Pretty obviously the Qantas spokesman said there was, and I quote, absolutely no link between the two incidents, which, yeah, I guess there wasn't. However, it would certainly have you thinking twice about getting on that aircraft, particularly if your crew, I mean, if you were prone to be superstitious, I guess.
Yeah, well, there is a certain friend of mine who will give me a yell and he'll be like, hey, well, actually, there's two of them now who do it. They'll SMS me before they jump on a plane and say, tell me about this aircraft. Here's its rego, because they'll be doing all they can to get the rego off the tail.
Yeah. The other interesting thing is it says here, following its previous incident, it cost $10 million to return the plane to service.
The Qantas board don't want to be the board that lost their first jet. Qantas have the enviable reputation of having never lost a jet airliner. When Oscar Juliet Hotel went off the end of the runway at Bangkok, a lot of people were saying it should have been written off. Large chunks of it were broken. They modified it, corrected it, repaired it, etc. at Bangkok, and flew it with just tech crew on board. No cabin crew, no passengers. And apparently on its first flight out of Bangkok, partway out, the emergency board lit up like a Christmas tree, and they turned around, landed, did some more work on it, and flew it back to Australia and got it majorly repaired. But yeah, they patched this one up in the Philippines, flew it back to Australia to do some major repairs on it. And again, better to repair than to be the ones who lose an aircraft. I believe Emirates are probably thinking the same thing about their A340.
Well, they probably are, Grant, and in a lovely segue, speaking of things that we're losing, or potentially losing, it looks like the Royal Australian Air Force's purchase of, or upcoming purchase, of 100 F-35 Joint Strike Fighters may be postponed, or the order may in fact be slashed.
Yeah, that's correct. Due to the dreaded global financial crisis, Australia's finding that they've got a funding gap of up to $15 billion in the defence budget, and all snowballing leading to the fact that they may only order 75 F-35s. Now, of course, if they do this, the unit rate goes up and so on. There's a lot of people suggesting that they should delay the F-35 anyhow to take advantage of later build aircraft. This is why the US are working pretty hard with multiple countries to try and offer a discount price to anyone who buys early.
Yeah, the original order called for $16 billion Australian dollars to be spent purchasing 100 aircraft, which would make 4 squadrons. The idea with that would be to replace the existing FA-18 Hornet fleet and, of course, the F-111s, although they're going at the end of this year. And the first aircraft are due to arrive from 2014. Now, what they're saying here is they're going to slash that dam, which would effectively mean instead of 4 squadrons, we'd end up with only 3.
We've got the Super Hornets now. We're bringing them online. They're acting as a bridging gap. You've got F-111 crews going to them, of course, because they've got the Wizzo in the back. You've got the standard F-18 guys going there. And so, like we did with when we bought the F-111s, we leased a bunch of F-4 Phantoms to keep everyone current and have a defense force until the F-111s came online. Well, looks like the F-18 Super Hornets are going to be bridging that gap, and there's even talk that, especially now that they're scaling back the F-35 order, there's talk that they may wind up with a 2-aircraft fleet and maintain the Super Hornets alongside the F-35s for a while.
It's reminiscent, isn't it, mate, because we're still operating the F-111s. I think if several governments had had ideal conditions, the F-111s would have been gone long ago. They don't and operate them anywhere else in the world these days. The other interesting thing here is that the government is saying they may also have to cut back their expansion plans for the Navy, including buying some extra submarines. So, yeah, it looks like things are a little bit tight. And our last story this week is dealing with our good friends at Tiger Airways. Yay, good old Tiger Airways. And this article appeared on the news.com.au site, and it says Australians reveal their, are you sitting down, folks, their worst airline.
Dun, dun, dun.
The Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. Oh, hang on. No, it doesn't say that. It says Australians have voted Tiger Airways their least favourite airline in new survey sets.
Yes, that was all the people who have been agreeing with us on the podcast. I tell you, the emails that we're getting all the time from disgruntled Australians, I don't know.
From all our three or four listeners.
Yeah, they're sending every day.
Thanks very much, Mum. Anyway, it also says here that Jetstar was rated the second lowest with a 60% satisfaction rate, and Virgin Blue was the most satisfactory at 68%, which, you know, mate, that's not a light flash either, I would have thought.
No, well, it's they indicate that travellers like the friendly crew that they find on Virgin Blue, but did find some people apparently did find their quirky onboard banter irritating.
Here's the ironic thing. If you look a bit further down the article here, it also has some international airline results, and Singapore Airlines was rated number one for overall satisfaction with 78%. Singapore Airlines, of course, as we've well documented here, owns Tiger Airways.
They're maintaining the distinction that they are about quality service, and people who fly on them are willing to pay the extra to get the service. And as our dear friend Rob Mark said in his latest Jetwine column, he gets what you pay for. And mate, I've totally got to agree with that. Anyone who shops around and pays the least amount of money possible to get a budget discount carrier and then bitches and moans about service, like we do, you know, it's I'm waking up to the realization that you get what you pay for. And
yes, yes, yes. But Grant, we don't want to emphasize that point too loud around Rob Mark. Remember,
there's a lot. Oh, yes. Sorry. Sorry, Rob.
Okay, let's just wind it up there, folks. That's everything we have for you this week on the Australia Desk. And if you're wondering, our American friends, why is it Father's Day here in Australia when it's not in the US? Well, that's pretty obviously, mate, because we measure time here metrically.
Yes, we're on the decimal date system. And according to the decimal date system, if you translate the imperial system back into the decimals, we're back in May. Told you we were ahead of everyone.
Get on board, mate. Metrics, it's a winner. And now that we've upset everybody, I think we'd better sign off. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
And we're getting out of here. Cheers, folks.
Bye.
We received a number of emails from listeners the past week. The first one came from Wing Companies. He writes, great sight, old chaps. You and your buddies like awesome aircraft pics, humorous air tales, glamorous sky girls. That's a question. You're all more than welcome to taxi over and drop by to say hello at the top secret bunker over at the Royal Air Farce. Biggin Hill, warmest regards. Wing Company. This is a website that actually I'd run across fairly recently. It's you can find this at Royal Air Farce. That's like farce.blogspot.com, and it's a kind of a humor site with a strong focus on aviation. So you can take a look at that. We also got an email from Kevin who wrote, "Now I see why Dan liked that V Australia booth." Wow. Kevin, of course, is referring to the photo of Dan from last episode with a couple of the V Australia booth attendants, which are reasonably appealing, I would say.
Yes, yes, real flight attendants.
The one thing that I noticed is that you're standing looking kind of cutely shy between these two girls, but your hands are at your side. And I was thinking that if I had been in that situation, I definitely would have had an arm around each waist.
Oh, I'm sorry, Max. So, next
for
year.
Next time, remember that. Richard writes in, howdy, thank you for all the great work by you all on AGP. I enjoy it a lot and look forward to it. If you're on Facebook, you might want to see my recent pics from a pilgrimage to Willow Run. Interesting. So, Richard, tell us which Richard on Facebook you are. When I searched for your first and last name, a lot of folks came up. So send us along some more specifics about where we can find you on Facebook, and we'll have a look at those photos.
Well, actually, Max, he sent a friend request to me. Apparently he didn't send one to you. So,
Or maybe he did, and I just sort of didn't quite get it. Okay, so...
Yeah, so they were some cool pictures.
All right. So, Dan, maybe you can tell me later which Richard this is. Chris Van Dusen writes in, greetings, airplane geeks. We came across your podcast and thought we should drop you an email and say hi. If you haven't heard of us before, MotoArt makes high-quality furniture and art pieces out of vintage airplane parts. For over 10 years, we have been helping people own a piece of aviation history. You can check out our site at www.motoart.com to see what products take flight. I'd actually been aware of MotoArt for quite a while. They have some really interesting stuff. As I wrote back to Chris, you know, where else can you find a desk lamp made out of a radial piston or a coffee table made out of a C-119 landing gear door? So it's not going to be the most inexpensive artifacts that you'll find around. But if you're in the market for kind of premium products with an aviation theme, they've got some really interesting stuff. And then finally, I think we have time for one more. Mini wrote in to say that he's working on a recording for us, and we're looking forward to that. We've been sort of exchanging emails with Mini back and forth to help him get sort of acclimated to some of the recording software that's available. And Dan, one final thing that I don't know if you noticed this, but last Saturday there was an interesting event. There's a guy on Twitter that goes by Aero Digital Life, and he started what he hopes to be a weekly IRC aviation chat. This happened Saturday at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on Undernet, something called Undernet, and the channel is plane_geek. So if you're interested in kind of a group of aviation enthusiasts chatting online all at the same time, you might want to follow Aero Digital Life on Twitter, and that's where you'll be able to hear about the announcement for the next chat.
Oh, I did not say I'll have to do that next time.
Thanks again to our guest, Jeffrey Ward. He's the Savvy Navigator. You can find him at savvynavigator.com. We'd also like to thank David Vanderhoof for his This Week in Aviation segment. And as always, Steve Vischer and Grant McCarron for sending us their Australia Desk report.
Now, Dan, we have to thank him for that, right?
We have to thank him for that because we want him to keep doing it.
All right. Okay. I just want.
Dan, now, how do people find you online?
Now, if they want to find me, and I have no idea why they would, but if they're so interested.
I'm starting to wonder, too.
thingsinthesky.com, Twitter, Dan Webbage, phone number, ask me, and we'll talk.
Terrific. Now we're going to be flying without you next week, right?
I know, but I will have an MP3 so people can still hear my silky smooth voice and perhaps a few mispronunciations.
Good, good. And Rob, how do people find you?
Well, the same place they keep finding us all the time, jetwine.com or on Twitter. It's also at jetwine.
And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com or Max Flight on Twitter. Be sure to follow the Airplane Geeks on Twitter. That's at Airplane Geeks. Visit us at airplanegeeks.com. You can leave a comment. You can sign up for the newsletter that Dan puts together each week, almost every week. or you can order your own Airplane Geeks t-shirt. All right, you can send an email to us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. You can leave us voicemail at 812-757-4252. Subscribe to us on iTunes or on the Zune Marketplace. And guys, you know how else people can help?
Send me care packages at school, specifically cookies.
We pay them to listen to us?
I don't, but if you guys do, great.
No, tell your friends
and be
everywhere
sure to,
around the globe.
And be sure to join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Night, everybody.
Ta-ta for now.
Okay, so does your roommate think you're a geek?
Everyone knows I'm a geek, Rob.
Okay.
Right. Well, one of my professors, whenever he sees me, like, he just, like, sticks his arms out and pretends he's, like, flying at this point.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So...